I'm your host, Ed Porter. Welcome back to Transmission. A solar array next to a hospital near Hull saves it about £1 million a year, enough to fund more than 50 nurses. That saving sat there for years, unbuilt, until today. GB Energy calls itself an activist investor, chasing down the frontiers private capital moves too slowly on. Deep water wind, long duration storage, solar on hospitals and schools. So what happens when a state-backed company starts making the bets that private money won't make first? Our guest today is Dan McGrail, CEO of GB Energy. He's the one setting the strategy on how consumers see the biggest benefit from this newly formed entity. If you have any questions about the build out of batteries, solar or wind in GB or Europe, that's what Co is for. Head to modoenergy.com to try now for free. Let's jump in. Hello, Dan. Welcome to Transmission.
Thank you for having me, Ed. It's lovely to be in an air-conditioned studio on a day of this impossible heat.
So. Yeah, we're into a second heat wave of the British summer, and yeah. The power prices in this one aren't quite so exotic as what we had in the first one. So
thankfully.
Okay, let's get straight into it. So what is one thing that everyone gets wrong about GB Energy?
I don't think it's one that everyone gets wrong, but it's one of the common themes is that, you know, GB Energy is an energy company, and our aspiration is to build an energy company in the model of other European state-owned energy companies.
So like an EDF?
Or Ørsted or Vattenfall or so on and so forth. You know, and so those are our long-term aspirations. And sometimes people approach us in the thought of, you know, that we're a government department. And, you know, yes, we're owned by the government, and Desnes is our shareholder. So we're very closely engaged with the whole world of energy policy. But we are a company and it's independently managed and operated in the interests of our shareholder, who is ultimately the British public. So, you know, I kind of want to make sure that people understand in the long run that we, you know, are the business we're building is in the mold, in the vision of having a British energy champion in the way that the Danes, the Norwegians, the Swedes, French have equivalent organizations.
And so perhaps reading between the lines of that, is that more saying that as a company, there's that commercial focus on the projects that you would engage in rather than how, say, Desnes might look at a market. Desnes might look at a market and say, we need to sponsor this very early stage project because it needs development money and it needs sort of a high risk attitude. But you would say, and in the same way that an EDF or a Vattenfall might say, they'd say, well, look, does it make sense for our investment committee to do this?
Yeah, and so we operate in exactly that way. We have an investment committee, but we, you know, I do think there's the one thing that a publicly owned energy company has differently is a duty and a responsibility to identify the frontiers where you're trying to move the energy market towards. And, you know, the way I kind of tend to encapsulate this is, where do we have high levels of national ambition, whether that's in, you know, the deployment of energy projects or whether it's in the technologies that underpin them, but the private capital isn't moving as freely or as quickly as we'd like it to. And that takes you down certain avenues. And when the way we developed our strategy and the way we thought about it was very much along the lines of, okay, yes, it, being additional to the energy market matters, but in the long run, we hope that that additionality in certain fields of technology will lead you into a space of sort of leadership. So if you take Ørsted as an example, you know, they started, yes, they were an oil and gas company that did a huge corporate transformation to offshore wind. And in doing so, built like really deep competence and know-how and became a leader in offshore wind to the extent that, yes, they are publicly owned, but they're publicly owned and a market leader. And that's sort of my hypothesis, is that you have to choose areas where you can build competence and ultimately differentiation in the long run in that aspiration of building an energy champion.
Mm-hmm. So it's not just that you're sort of naturally drawn to the frontiers, but there is this, if you commercially want to try and get ahead, you need to think not just to do the same thing that all the other companies are already doing. You're trying to find the niche and the edge where you think that there's not quite so much activity today, and you can build up that expertise. And then in the long run, that would allow you to then hold a much bigger position.
Yeah. And also, you know, you've got to be careful not to crowd out private capital, because, you know, there are areas where the energy market is doing, you know, superb work. And if you just look at what's been done in this country over the last, you know, decade or so in terms of like moving generation capacity, particularly on the generation side, right? I think, you know, there's lots of areas where they've, you know, they've been sort of slower progress, but on the generation side, you know, that transformation of the energy system towards a much more renewables heavy system, the exit of coal, that has been driven by policy, and it's been driven by private innovation and private capital. So we clearly don't want to go into spaces that just crowd that out. You know, that's working well. We want to go into the spaces where we're actually trying to do the converse, where you're trying to crowd it in. So an example of that is, and no doubt we'll come on to storage later, but if you, you know, maybe just to stay with generation for a second, if you take offshore wind, we've done a really good job in Britain of sort of building out the pipeline, but we're getting to the point where, you know, we need to build offshore wind in deeper and deeper water. And that frontier hasn't been crossed yet. And there are companies that are willing to take that, but they kind of need the patient activist investment of a GB Energy to help, you know, build that pipeline into the future and sort of carry the confidence across that frontier. So, you know, that's why we kind of very early in our development, we sort of say, let's make an investment in that space, and we continue to explore it. And other areas are like long duration energy storage, where, you know, I think nobody's really cracked deploying LDES at scale. So, you know, that's a clearly an area where we think, yes, there's a role for an activist patient investor. But at the same time, whilst we're doing that work, we can build knowledge and capability along the way.
Yeah. I think this sort of activist investor is a nice way of describing it. When you sort of originally said, you know, we're a government-owned company, but we are sort of commercial in nature. And then you went to say, well, if all of these sort of commercial companies are already doing this thing, so we're going to go and do something else. I felt, oh, that's like, if I look at the other sort of national energy companies, they don't really do that. Actually, lots of them crowd around each other doing the same thing. They chase sort of safe projects. But as you're saying, if you describe yourself as that activist investor, then you, with a sort of slightly longer term view, then that, to me, explains why you're not doing exactly the same thing as others, and you might be looking for things like floating wind.
Yeah.
Maybe let's follow through floating wind. I know wind's your background as well, which is a nice place to be. Where is floating wind today in terms of its development in GB, and how did GB Energy see it? How are you getting involved?
Well, the first thing we've tried to do is change the narrative from being just about floating wind to be about deep water. We talk about deep water a lot because there's a technology maturity and convergence that needs to happen in that space. And what we've done in Britain in this world is, obviously, we've exploited very well the shallower sea.
Yeah.
We've even pushed the frontier of what we think shallow is into sort of working into deeper and deeper territories, but we've probably pushed the boundary of what's possible with let's say conventional fixed bottom wind,
like
a monopile,
like a scaffolding or a monopile,
or a jacket as the industry calls it, you know, which is basically, as you say, like a kind of modular steel structure. So you get to a point where you have to find different ways to do this. And, you know, we see, you know, what we've done as a country is we've leased in Scotland and in the Celtic Sea significant parts of the seabed for development of these deeper water projects. That was done to a certain extent with quite a lot of fanfare and optimism, I think, at a time in history, in 2021 ScotWind, where economic conditions were quite benign, you know, in a post-pandemic world, you know, interest rates were low, geopolitical situation was relatively, you know, maybe benign is the wrong word, but, you know, we were kind of coming out of the pandemic maybe with a degree of sort of optimism for growth. And then Ukraine happened, and we saw inflation in supply chains kind of moved the economic dial on nascent technology of various different types. In fact, energy technology of all types, particularly because there's a big, you know, the cost of steel went up, the cost of aluminium, the cost of nickel, you know, all of these kind of key components that we need to build energy infrastructure.
And critically, the cost of capital.
And
as well.
The cost of capital went up, you know, and that's really crucial. Now, does the world's, does our need for those technologies fall away? No, we need, you know, we're energy transition is, you know, is ongoing. It is going to continue for quite some time, and electrification of the economy, you know, the kind of calls for all sorts of new technologies to be brought about. But that's an area where I think, if we're frank, you know, it's not made the progress that we want. And it's because of those externalities. So what we, you know, then kind of conclude is, look, you know, some injection of confidence that mm-hmm. this is important in the long run. And I often say about deep water wind and, you know, floating and what have you, is that you need to have real faith in the destination in order to set off on the journey. And the reason that is the case is because, you know, building these types of wind farms at scale requires, you know, big investment in port infrastructure, you know, big fabrication facilities, a lot of investment in skills. And that's just to kind of get you on the runway. So, you know, you've got to have that kind of long-term infrastructure thinking to be able to do it. And okay. and that's why we felt it was a very clear role for us.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we can see that we have faith in the destination, but also I think we, as a, you know, as a sectoral, you know, base body who, in other words, people who understand the market and the technology, that we would be bringing a clarity on not only what needs to happen, but also how it should be done to the landscape.
Well, let's follow this kind of thread through, because I think it's a good example, right, to get straight into with this, with the concepts of sort of deeper offshore wind. Mm-hmm. Is it your role? So you talked about this kind of onshoring or making sure the ports are fit for purpose and you have the kind of capability that sits around those sites. And I agree with you, like if you're going to develop those projects, you have to have the capability within the country to enable supply chain and enable construction of these these floating wind turbines. But is it your role to do that, as a sort of an energy company backed by government or government owned energy company? Should you be thinking about an investment in infrastructure like the ports, or is your role not to say, well, somebody else should think about the port and we should be thinking about the project itself, that's the floating offshore park?
And I think, you know, look, the big infrastructure investments like ports. So let me take a step back,
okay,
if I may. So we've embarked on a strategy which has kind of got sort of three pillars and one thing that's overarching. And I'll come back to your question in a moment. But the three pillars of offshore and deep water, onshore in particular, focus on, you know, a couple of aspects. One is sort of LDES, one is utilizing public land more effectively, and then local and community energy. Very different, very discrete parts of a business.
And LDES is long duration energy storage.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah, forgive me for the first
of course.
Jargon utilization today. And then right the way across that is the subject of supply chain. And we think supply chain is important for a number of reasons. One is for a resilience reason. You know, I think increasingly there are areas where, you know, we need to sort of to de-risk our future of energy transition and reduce dependency on other sources or other countries, but also because, look, you know, this is fundamentally one of the most interesting economic opportunities of our era. We live in a time when, you know, the big things that are happening in the world are, you know, AI, there's a demographic change, urbanization, and energy transition or climate related stuff. And I feel quite strongly that there needs to be prosperity that arises locally out of that. If you think about the way that the energy system used to look, you know, a big coal-fired power station or a big nuclear powered station, power station would have a massive local impact and a massive local benefit, mostly in terms of jobs. And renewables is different in that regard, because it has a big local impact, but it has a distributed benefit. And that is arguably one of the breaks on the energy transition, is people feeling that they're not benefiting from hosting infrastructure in their community. And that's why I think, you know, what people really care about isn't necessarily where their electricity comes from, you know, the people switch their electric, their light on in the morning, or they plug in their electric car or whatever it might be. And the, you know, we ought to take it for granted. But what they do care about is whether their children have got employment opportunities or an apprenticeship or, you know, aspiration in their local area. So bringing it back to your question about this, about wind, it's like, you know, you're right. There are other actors who are much better positioned to invest in things like ports. But what we want to do is unlock the things that go on them.
Okay.
The factories, the service companies, the technology companies that drive employment, you know, innovation and long-term footprint. Because when you've finished building the wind farms and we've done the energy transition, the legacy that I would like there to be afterwards is that we have built deep international know-how that when other countries around the world are going through their transition, that they rely on engineering and technology and jobs that are here in Britain. Mm-hmm. Now, that can't be across everything. It's got to be in areas where you are, you know, excellent, and you decide that you're going to be excellent. But you can do that within many aspects of the energy transition. So again, within floating wind, we in Britain are excellent at subsea engineering. You know, we have done this through the oil and gas industry. We kind of pioneered offshore oil and gas. We pioneered working in really deep water, to the extent that almost, you know, any offshore oil and gas project in the world was probably engineered at least partially from Britain. So, and my aspiration simplistically is that we end up in the same place with the renewables transition and in this case with deeper water offshore wind.
Yeah, I think it's I think it's fascinating because it's kind of the competition between a company wanting to be commercial and then also this kind of longer term vision of jobs, which I'd say most other companies don't think about too much as a like top priority. Like probably they worry more about the sort of the bottom line before they worry about sort of the long term of jobs for the particular country they're based in. So that is different. I think there's also this concept that you're thinking about exporting skill sets. I mean, I look at the energy industry in GB, we have a lot of other national energy companies that have brought their expertise in to GB. I mean, there's loads of examples. I mean, maybe to leave physical stuff for a second, there are loads of examples of trading businesses where like trading expertise from Europe also like plays in the GB market as well. Mm. And so that clearly happens one way. I would be very excited to see GB exporting once again lots of its infrastructure know-how to other parts of the world. But I wonder, and maybe this is kind of where we're going to get to on this, I wonder whether it's the role of a sort of a company that is trying to maximize profit to do that, or whether it's the role for like a government to try and do it. And you sit in this kind of like gray zone in between, which is why I think it's quite interesting.
Yeah, I think the difference is, I mean, you use the word, you know, maximize profit. And I think there's commercial and commercial instinct doesn't necessarily need to lead you down the road of maximizing stuff. It can lead you into the world of saying, okay, what? And I would argue, look, I've spent most of my career in the private sector. I'm a very much a private sector thinker, but I would say that the company that I started my career in, you know, I didn't join a company whose mission statement was all about maximizing profits. I joined a company whose mission statement was very much about, impact and legacy. And, you know, I think that, you know, there were various different strap lines, make real what matters, or, you know, technology for every day and stuff like that. You know, you kind of have a purpose that goes beyond return. And that's what makes companies last a really long time. Mm. And the other thing I'd say is, look, and, you know, maybe the reason why things are coming one way and not coming the other is because there have been companies in, you know, in Sweden and Denmark and Norway who've had a purpose that goes beyond. You know, if it's just about return, then it leads you down certain roads. It leads you down the roads of maybe lower risk, or maybe leads you down the road of, you know, taking more risk, but only doing so because you really want to maximize return. For us, we might take more risk because we want to maximize benefit. We want to maximize impact. And the return matters, but it isn't the reason. The reason is something more.
Yeah.
And that's what I think public ownership can deliver for people, as opposed to just wholly private ownership. Mm. And I'm not saying it's either or. That's the thing. It's not either or. It can be, those two things can coexist quite comfortably. I don't talk about public investment very much, but I talk about public entrepreneurship. This is about us understanding how to share risk, how to work with the private sector together, and doing so with outcomes in mind, and whether those outcomes are employment or they're about, you know, accelerating the transition or, you know, making sure that there's more specific regional outcomes. And we should talk about other areas of our strategy, but ultimately about making sure that, you know, there are transition opportunities for other industries. These can all be comfortable missions that sit alongside each other.
Next I want to go to local energy, mm-hmm. And the role you're playing in local energy, because I think that's really interesting, and it's another part of that strategy leg. But just before we go there, you mentioned just working alongside other private companies. So how do you get that right when you're working alongside other private companies? Where is the are they sort of excited to see you on projects together because it's like an equity injection type thing, or are they sort of just trying to sound out exactly how GB Energy is going to function? What's the right role that you play alongside private investment into these projects?
So look, I'll take a step back to answer the question. When I was early in my career at Siemens, we spent some time developing a wind turbine factory, which I led in Hull now. And when I was developing that project, I took it to the board of the company, and the question from the board of the company very reasonably was, well, what happens if the UK government changes its mind on offshore wind?
Yeah.
What should we do? I think that's a question that any board responsibly would ask about building a business in, you know, a nascent area. And the present, one of the things that drew me to working for GB Energy and leading this was the concept that actually, if there had been a GB Energy around when I was taking that project through approvals, mm-hmm. I'd have been able to answer that question easier, because I'd been able to say, look, you know, the government is putting the British public are putting the stake in this and sharing the risk and the opportunity that comes from it. So I probably would have been able to deliver that project sooner because I'd have been able to answer that question quicker. And so I came into this job with a hypothesis that the market would like the idea of this to work alongside. And to my pleasant surprise, when I started, GB Energy had received inbound inquiries of like north of 50 gigawatts, which for the energy, you know, sort of layperson, that's about the same amount of energy as the whole British energy system at the moment.
It's like our peak demand
when the aircon's on.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly.
So this was without cultivating the market. This was just unsolicited inquiries.
And when you say inbound, that's people who were saying, pitching a project to you and saying,
exactly,
Dan, would you like to come along and invest in it?
So, okay. You know, we had to unpick that and work out, okay, where do we think the best places are for us to act? But As a confirmation of the interest of the market in having GB Energy participation, that was really strong sort of confirmation to me.
So going back to that question, my question was, how do you work alongside private capital, private investment? And you're saying it doesn't really matter. They just wanted to come and work with us straight away
It's not that I'm saying it doesn't really matter, because there are things that matter to us. Now, that was when I started. Now I'm like, you know, a year in, we started to build it. We've built a strategy. And the strategy is, you know, is a built around the three pillars that I mentioned. But also, look, you know, we are open-minded to coming into projects at the development phase, for example, to work alongside and share the risk in development capital, because development capital is probably the riskiest part of projects. We're open-minded to coming into projects at the investment decision point during construction risk. Mm-hmm. And we are open-minded to taking ownership in assets in the long run. Now, that is different depending on the various different technologies. Clearly, an investment in a big offshore wind farm, or for example, at into enduring operation is a much bigger ticket than, you know, us owning a solar farm or a battery storage project or so on and so forth. Mm. You know, so we have to be selective about how we use our capital in that regard. But we are working with people at various different points of the value chain where we think it really helps to increase that confidence of the private sector.
Okay. Thank you. That's and I did promise I was going to get onto local energy, and I do definitely still want to get there. But I want to ask one more question first, which is, you're very interested in supply chain. You're very interested in enabling and this sort of activist investment side. When I look at the energy market in GB, I think one of the things that worries me the most is probably the sort of electrically qualified or EPC, so the companies that would construct some of these projects. I worry that we don't have enough people to do the work that we need to do. Mm-hmm. And I think it's really high risk. And my brain is kind of like, as simple as it is, it's just saying, hey, look, is this something that GB Energy could be involved in? But I think from your question, your answer so far, I would say no, because that's more of a sort of, almost that's more of a government type initiative rather than a sort of—
And this is in some ways back to your first question. It's like, we're a company, we're not a government department. And I think, but to your point on skills and skills development, you know, we are publicly owned. So there are things that we should be exemplar in the skills landscape. We should make sure that we are driving, you know, apprenticeships. We should be supporting local developments of skills. We should be, where we are investing in supply chain, we should be using our influence to ensure employment standards are excellent, that, you know, if there's an opportunity for the role of trade unions, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. You know, so there are spaces where we can use our influence as a publicly owned investor for good.
Okay.
What I would say about the wider skills transition is, I think I agree with you, at least conceptually, but I think when you get to start to break it down, and in my old role at Renewable UK, we did a lot of work looking at the skills required to deliver just the offshore wind industry's needs. And when you look at the big numbers and you go, oh, crikey, there's a lot of people needed in offshore wind. The industry employs about 55,000 people today. About 100,000 are needed to deliver the sort of upper limits of the government's aspirations. Now, a lot of those numbers are not constrained skills. And it should be framed more as opportunity. There's loads of opportunity for all sorts of different types of people from all sorts of different backgrounds. But there are some scarce skills. And, you know, so electrically qualified people, I think, is a real national issue that goes beyond any one sector. Mm. But I think industries have a huge responsibility in solving that, because they know better than anyone what they need.
And so you should be exemplar in terms of how you're finding those people to join your projects, but it's not your responsibility.
I don't think it's GB's and skills is it's also a devolved issue. It's a very local issue. And therefore it's more about being an active part of an ecosystem that solve this. And to your point on electrically qualified people, you know, there are a huge range of variations on that. We'll need people to install EV chargers, heat pumps, solar panels on roofs.
Yeah.
People understand how to install batteries. Electrification is just this huge national change. People are used to working with internal combustion engines, but need to work with batteries. People are used to working with gas boilers, need to work with heat pumps. You know, so you've got this kind of mechanical to electrical switch. And I think that transcends energy, automotive, construction, and therefore that's an education issue, a skills issue, which sits at a level, you know, beyond any one sector. But we all need to come together to work on it.
So as a fun question, and maybe taking off a GB Energy hat for a second, if I was to ask you at age 16, if you can dial back the clock to when you were 16 or 22 coming out of university, and if you were in those shoes that people are today, like, where would you go in the energy sector? Where do you think your first job would be if you got the chance to choose again?
Well, when I was 16, everyone was going off to work in oil and gas. So it was like, you know, but the world changed. And so if I was, you know, now, it's a really good question. Look, I say to my children, maybe that's the better thing. You know, I really try to encourage my children to think about engineering as a profession. And technical skills, and enjoy maths, enjoy science. If I was to look back at myself at 16, I'd probably said, well, why didn't you listen in physics a little bit more, you know? But I think if you build up that base level of understanding of mechanical, electrical, and software, and probably AI, you know, that opens up And my dad said this to me when I was 16, and I say it to my kids now, the best thing you can have is options. And one thing about having those, if you have those sort of four areas, is you've got loads of options, because you can go into high voltage, you can go into working in automotive, you can go into working infrastructure. Mm. But if you can give yourself those sort of core base sort of understanding in the technical world, then that gives you the most options whatsoever. So yeah. I know that isn't an answer to your question.
I was going
to
say,
but I don't think it's fair for me to say, I think, you know, one thing is better than the other, but energy transition is going to go on for a really long time. Mm. And therefore there is a generational career in this. And I think that's a really exciting thing for people.
There's a fascinating like 10 to 20 years of transition going on. And if you're thinking about where to go, like, I hope you're excited about that. Yeah. We certainly are. Let's move on to local energy, because I promised it earlier, and we should get there. I don't know. Maybe I'm a bit of a skeptic on it. But let's get into it. So how does it fit into your overall strategy? And maybe to my skeptic side, why do we need it?
So I think I would be the first to admit I come from big infrastructure. So when I came into this role, it was important to learn. And I think skepticism is fine if you're willing to learn about it. And if you're skeptical because you just don't believe, then that's probably just, you know, ignoring it. And what I think what is the most powerful thing is to go and see it in action. Okay. And it's not about the wind turbine or the solar farm. It's about the impact. And so I'm going to go to a place called Shapensay in Orkney. It's an island off Orkney. Where I went to, I spent a few days in Orkney, and it was fascinating because embedded local energy is really normal. Orkney's got about 22,000 people who live there. There are 800 wind turbines. I mean, you know, distributed across a number of islands, which is in terms of a concentration is really high. Levels of EV uptake, levels of heat pump uptake, levels of solar uptake are way above national average. And one of the reasons why, and this isn't without a world without its challenges, but one of the reasons why is the huge benefits. And at Shapensay, they put up a 900 kilowatt turbine, and they'd done it at a time during, following the financial crisis, in which funding had been cut by the local authority. And they were sort of out of necessity thinking, what do we do here to fund our essential services? So they built this turbine, and it's owned by a development trust by the island, which has then gone on to become the biggest employer on the island, because the profits that are generated from that scheme are then reinvested in the community. Now, I know you will probably be asking your question and the skeptical question from an energy system perspective, but I kind of wanted to start it from the kind of human end, because That development trust now is building social housing. It's improving insulation for people who have got fuel poverty issues. They're funding bus services so people can get around the island. They've put on extra ferries so that people can get to work on time and stuff like that. So it's having a social impact that far outweighs a wind turbine. Mm-hmm. Right? And I think that you kind of got to start with that potential. To come to your energy system, I think, angle. I think there's a huge role for in the long run for sort of smart local energy systems to sort of act as sort of spongy nodes on the system where we can sort of manage supply and demand. I don't think it's all about energy generation. I think it's about how you optimize generation, demand, storage in concert with the wider energy system. And I don't think that's about any one solution. I think it's about how you work out the right role that energy can play in a local environment and in a local setting. So one last point on this is that the impact that this can have in the public sector, right, and outcomes. I went to a hospital in near Hull where they had a field next to their hospital, and they built a solar array, which was saving them about £1 million a year as a hospital, saving them £1 million a year. Now, I don't know how they're spending that money, but if they wanted to, that £1 million a year could fund north of 50 nurses.
And GB Energy's done a lot of work, right? Putting solar onto hospitals, onto schools.
Absolutely.
Where that opportunity has been sat there all this time, but until GB Energy came along and said, hey, look, we're pushing this, it didn't come through.
And you know, if you are running a public sector organization, capital is scarce, you're going to prioritize the things that are the closest to your core mission. So if you have capital in
paying
hospitals,
for nurses, training new nurses, not building PV, that's unnecessary. I don't need it.
It's of course, one of the things that was interesting, I'll give you another example. I went to a school where it was a multi-academy trust. They had some like 28 schools in this trust. And during the energy crisis, their cost of electricity across that estate had gone up by £500,000. Mm-hmm. So it's not core. Energy is not core for a school. But as soon as the cost goes up by £500,000 across a number of schools, then it becomes pretty important. Mm. And they had put in solar, not on all 28. They'd done it, managed to do it. You know, not every building was appropriate for it, but they had significantly deployed it. It was probably on, say, 20 to 23, something like that, of their school estate. And more than offset that to the point that their payback period was under 5 years for that investment. Well, that's phenomenal. It's phenomenal. But they had done it and they'd been able to do it because the unique way they were financed, and also because ultimately this cost had become core. Our point on this is, look, this can be not only transformational for the education and the healthcare outcomes, and you know, we can think about all the settings where this can be done, but also in settings like social housing, where you can kind of give a direct benefit to households, especially if you start to combine that with battery storage. Because, you know, things like charging our EVs in the future is going to be an important matter, and making sure people have access to low-cost energy to do that is going to be really important.
It is so important to get the battery storage alongside the solar. If you just have the solar on all of these demand centres, effectively you create a demand that gets really spiky around the peak. And
we saw what happened in Germany when that, you know, the feed-in tariff was sort of massively oversubscribed, you know, a long time ago. And what that did is it meant there was 35 gigawatts of energy coming onto the network every morning and coming off every night. Mm. And then the result was balancing that with brown coal. Mm.
And it creates stress on the system.
So it's the stress, you do need to avoid that. And I think you're absolutely right, making sure that you balance that. And again, that makes the challenge even bigger for, you know, social housing providers or for schools or hospitals, is that, you know, batteries have just increased the capital cost of doing this really well. And if we come at it from an energy sector perspective, understanding that those outcomes that I referred to earlier in terms of the communities, but also in terms of the public sector, when we think about them and we bring an energy lens to it, we can maybe do it better than if it's done in a kind of disorganized way at a lower cost.
So that disorganized thing, that's the bit that I'm a little bit worried about. So I have a solar panel, and I have more than one solar panel. I've got 10, it's exciting. And a battery together. I love it. This is a bit of double think. I'm a huge advocate of having that on your home. But at the same time, the bit that worries me is a little bit like Germany's distribution network operators. There's kind of one grid in Germany, effectively. Well, there's four transmission network operators, and then there's 800 plus distribution network operators. And I kind of think, Christ, running a system with like 800 individual network operators, isn't that just the most chaotic thing possible? And that, to me, is a little bit of the worry about local energy, is that if you had to run 800 or 10,000 local energy companies, it could be a real nightmare. But if you have governance that means it's all sort of run efficiently from one sort of mother company, perhaps, then perhaps it could be done very nicely. I'm not sure where I land on this, but that's the bit that worries me a little bit.
I think maybe it's in the language. So I agree. I think if you have lots of network operators, then it would become complex. But if you've got lots of system operators, and it's smart from the get-go, and it's integrated, then it can work in a different way. So I don't think it's necessarily about how it's, I mean, and we live in an era where, you know, the sheer potential for autonomous thinking and stuff to happen here is, you know, massively interesting. But you've got to get there, you know, in a way where you create rules of the game and do it in an integrated way, I think.
Okay. I want to ask two more questions. There was a headline around 8.3 billion. I think that's the right number for GB Energy originally. How are you getting on with spending that? how much is left? How much has been committed?
Oh, look, we're just getting, like, being realistic, we're just getting started. And whilst, I won't go into the numbers in detail. They're in the public domain if people want to research them. But clearly, no one expected us to do all that in week one, right? So we're at the end of a year one. So we had an Act of Parliament on the 15th of May, 2025. We're sitting here today in July 26. And thankfully, the planning allowed us some time to, you know, get match fit, build our business, build our team. Yeah. We have started with, we've made investments in the Pentland offshore wind farm. We've made investments in ITM Power, the hydrogen electrolyzer manufacturer. We've got a number of investments that, you know, obviously commercially sensitive, I can't talk about, but that we are working on this year. We've launched our first fund on the supply chain investments and grants. So we are making progress. And we'll publish an annual report and everyone can read the details in that. Yeah.
Okay. Okay. No firm answer, but I did enjoy the World Cup reference sneaking in, saying about match fit, which is great to see. Okay. Which leads me to my final question, which is around a contrarian view. So what is something that you believe in energy markets that not everyone believes?
Probably a few, but I maybe stick with the kind of industrial bit. I think recent history has shown us that people believe the best way to deliver energy markets is to deliver energy outcomes is to build markets and buy the cheapest, work out how to get the cheapest thing. Mm. And I believe that for a very, very, you know, small change in behavior, we can build real industrial legacy in Britain. And it's not because it's all about us having local content. It's because we value industry and we should value industry more than perhaps we have. But we also have something to offer. And I give you the example, maybe somewhere close to where I started, which is in, like, if you take wind turbine blades, you know, we in Britain are fantastic aerodynamic engineers. There's a reason why we make wings for aircraft here. We are brilliant. There's also a reason why we have all the Formula One teams here, because we're great aerodynamic engineers. We're also brilliant with composite materials. Composite materials, again, aircraft wings, we've got some world-class composite capability. They are in adjacent sectors. And the more that we draw them in to wind turbine blades, we can become world-class at not only the making them, but how you make them, how you engineer the future of them, how you make them more efficiently, how you do it with higher quality. Mm-hmm. So you become like a world center in that particular thing.
Yeah.
And again, like if I come back to aerospace, you know, aerospace has a strategy that says we do four things really well in Britain. We do wings, we do landing systems, we do propulsion systems, and we do avionics. Those are the four things Britain is world-class at. Mm-hmm. And I think we should be developing an industrial approach to energy that says, and these are our four things or five things or whatever it is, and that we really invest in that with our whole innovation ecosystem, all our public finance ecosystem, and become a real center of excellence. And that isn't about having 50, 60, 70% local content. It's about having 50, 60, 70% global market share in those areas. And that, I think that's where we should become.
Because, you know, the narrative would be this all exists in China and China does it so well at such low cost that you just can't even compete with it. And you're saying, I'm not trying to make a manufacturing supply chain that is a replica of China's tomorrow. No. I'm saying we should try and find parts of this where we are genuinely excellent and we can contribute to a global supply chain of this rather than try and sort of stand up our own version of a replica industry.
100%. That's what I'm saying. Okay. What is our value proposition as Britain to the world in energy transition? And I mentioned, like, wind turbine blades is a great example. I could talk about, you know, subsea technologies, subsea cables, all of these kind of things where we could become real global champions and build industries that outsurvive the energy transition in this country and our export into the world for many years to come. That's my aspiration and hope.
Dan, thank you very much for coming on Transmission. You've been a wonderful guest.
Thank you very much indeed. It's been a pleasure.